And so the enormous variety of fauna that we actually see at the Great Yorkshire Show continues. We're actually just at the Yorkshire Falconry Club, and we're speaking to...
Mike,
good to get together. I feel as though we should actually be speaking to your colleague as well, who's sitting very patiently perched, in fact, as a falcon. And what's this chap's name?
This is Cassie. She's a four-year-old female havisook. And she's in mulch at the moment. She's looking a bit scruffy, but she's coming along nicely.
I think she's looking on top form, basically. The level of control, obviously we've seen falconry demonstrated a whole range of things here, but really in terms of actually focusing on it, they're very intelligent birds, aren't they?
Yes, the havisook is up there with the best of them. The havisook will work as a pair or in a group of, say, four or five animals, which you can all fly at the same time. If you've got birds that are used to each other, they will quite happily cooperate with each other to actually get the end result. With this being a hunting bird, it is a means to an end. They are hopefully... what you hope to do during the season is to make it so that they basically feed themselves.
I was thinking for a moment there, it was just a boring interview because Cassie seemed to be yawning, but it's all right, Cassie, we'll keep you entertained for too long. Francesca, questions?
How long have you worked with the Falconry Club?
I've been with the club about 10 years now.
And I was just noticing as you were just giving a little stroke down her front there, she was having a little nibble at you. Now, she's got quite a wicked-looking beak there. Is that painful?
With birds of prey, especially a havisook or something like this, it's more a case of the beak isn't the problem. It's the feet that you have to be careful of. If I'm preening her, if I'm having a play with her, she'll be preening me. It's like a confidence thing. She's quite happy with what I'm doing, she's preening me. If you put more than one together, you'll see them actually standing next to each other, preening each other. So like one will preen round the neck and the other one will preen it as well. It's just a confidence thing for the bird.
And a few name checks for your colleagues who are sitting in the background doing all sorts of things whilst they're watching you do the interview here. Who have we got here?
We've got Chris, Adrian, Mark...
Remember the name, I'm sure. Hillary. How could we forget Hillary, though, in all sorts of ways, though? Fantastic stuff.
He's got Maddie on her fist, 5-year-old.
Okay, and sorted too. And if people want to get involved, obviously www.yorkshirefalconry.org.uk is the best way to contact you if they can't get to the Great Yorkshire Show this year.
Yeah, that would do us. That'd be lovely.
I mean, if people are thinking of taking this up as a hobby and wanted to get more involved, you said you've been involved with it for 10 years yourself. I mean, roughly how long would it take to actually come up to speed?
I would suggest it takes probably a year to actually decide whether the bird's right for you. Right. Because at the end of the day, the bird that you've got can live anything up to 25 years.
Exactly. I mean, we are talking long term.
They're not a two-minute commitment.
No, precisely.
Not a two-minute commitment at all, as far as...
It's a lifelong partnership, as Cassie's obviously agreeing. Well, isn't that right? Yeah.
Sorted through. Well done.
Is it an expensive hobby?
The setting up is the expense. Building the aviary, getting the telemetry... investing in the bird, and it's also investing in your time. It's to make sure that you have the time to actually do it. It's not something you can just pick up as and when. It's something you have to do every day.
And what do you have to do every day?
There's this time of year when they're molting, it's just feeding. When it comes to later on in the year when you decide to fly your bird, there's weight control, food control, exercise, making sure they're clean, making sure they're healthy, and all that sort of thing. If you've got to take it to the vet, you might have to travel because these need a specialist vet.
It's a very specialised area then, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's exotics. The exotics is the thing about it.
Well, as I often say, the joy of actually wandering around the Great Yorkshire Show is it keeps you relatively fit and moves you uphill and down dale in all sorts of ways. And we've now actually encountered a fabulous roadshow, which is the Opal Weather Roadshow with Opal Explore Nature. And we're speaking to...
Dr. Sylvia Knight from the Royal Meteorological Society.
Fantastic. Now, obviously, we speak a great deal on the radio with meteorologists. They're always being chastised in all sorts of ways. And I know that Hannah Bayman, who's our regular BBC North meteorological correspondent, is always saying, but the BBC, we read meteorologists. We actually go on courses and they're approved and all the rest of bits and pieces. It's becoming much more of an exact science, step by step, but it's still open to what I call fuzzy logic, isn't it?
It's not quite. quite fuzzy logic, okay. But it's never going to be completely precise, and we're certainly never going to be able to make a weather forecast for more than about 10 days ahead. But we're getting better all the time.
So when you're dealing with anemometer, I think, if we're looking for wind speeds and various other bits and pieces, satellites obviously come into play. Do you make much more use of obviously satellite information as well as obviously the sort of standard ground evidences for gathering data?
We make a lot of use of satellite data, but there's only so much that a satellite can tell you. Satellites are good for things like the temperature of the atmosphere, what sort of clouds are around, that sort of thing. But a satellite will never be very good at telling us where it's raining or how heavy it's raining or what the wind speeds are or anything like that. So we have ground-based instruments, we have ocean-based instruments, and we also have things like radar to tell us where it's raining.
So we've come ahead, come along a bit further from looking at the sweet seaweed or various other techniques, presumably.
Definitely, yeah.
Excellent. Okay, Leslie.
I'm just wondering, is your interest general or is there a particular area that you're most interested in?
Well, here at the moment with the roadshow, we've been touring the country with this roadshow, and at times we've been having booked school groups through, and we've got a whole load of experiments and demonstrations that they can have a go at, from making clouds in bottles to having a go at doing a weather forecast with the green screen weather forecasting technology, looking at the weather station, all that sort of thing. But here today at the show, we're open for anybody, and we're certainly getting interest from all ages.
See, I'm thinking, as she's actually doing her work placement with us, and as she's obviously looking to head into the acting and presenting world, we should actually give Fran the opportunity of doing some green screen work. I mean, it sounds like a challenge to me. I mean, do you think that's a possibility?
She can definitely have a go. It's harder than it looks.
Exactly. Fran, are you up for this, becoming the weather girl Fran for Southside Broadcasting?
I suppose since we're recording, I can't really say no.
Can, but thankfully she didn't, so excellent stuff on that basis. Right, well, we're in your capable hands. Would you like to just talk us through what she's going to be doing then?
Okay, well, if you'd like to step inside the trailer.
We'll keep recording as the thing goes through from this sort of point of view, so you can explain the magical stuff, because obviously, as we all know, colour separation, overlay and green screen, it's a wonderful device. But I see the sort of scenario that's coming up there, and obviously we're getting an interesting forecast of ice and frost from this sort of point of view. So.
You want to stand about there? So this way a bit. I'll move it down a bit. There you go. So a little bit further. And the first thing you'll notice is that everything's in mirror image. Yeah. So you want to use your left hand and you hold it back against the screen. And you'll be forecasting for a cold winter's night. And so you want to try and point in roughly the right place and then tell us what the weather in those places is going to be doing.
The problem is that I can't actually read a map, so I don't know where any...
Sad state of education, etc. Don't worry, if the top is Scotland, Fran, then as we move down on the east-hand side, we've got Middlesbrough. Okay, then if you go down further, you've got London, you've got the South Counties, you've got the South West, you've got the South East. You can even do either. You're pointing at Scotland at present, exactly.
It's really Scotland. It's very early in Scotland at the moment. And we move down to...
Slight hazard of ice with respect to that. I'll tell you what, we'll work through that. With clouds and snow actually focused for the northeast of England. Very freezing, 0 degrees centigrade as we head down to Humberside and the East Midlands. And in the south, it's getting slightly easier with temperatures of 1 and 2 degrees just above freezing, but we'd still say wrap up well. Is that the kind of thing you're looking for?
That's the kind of thing, yes. You didn't have to do the pointing, though, so you had an easy job.
It's nice to actually have somebody to do the pointy for me. That's all. Always get somebody else to do the pointy. Excellent. I mean, again, wonderful way of actually showing how people can actually learn and appreciate the forecast and get the whole thing together, really, because again, as I was saying, ITV make a big thing about this, but it's more sort of weather presenters as opposed to BBC, which is weather trained.
Yes, the BBC forecasters will have written the forecast themselves, decided what information needs to be put across, and they run everything themselves. They do it all. Yes.
So for folk who are listening to this and they're listening to it on podcast, where is the Opal Explore Nature roadshow going next?
That's a very good question, for which I'll have to pass you over to my colleague.
Excellent. Well, we'll work through that, etc. And we're speaking to...
Nathan Sparks.
Hi, Nathan. Okay, now, you look as though you've got a fantastic piece of equipment here. What are you about to be doing with this particular device? Making rain?
This is a tornado generator.
So
okay. It simulates the process of an atmospheric tornado.
Do we need a tornado at the Great Yorkshire Show this time?
Well, this should be a safe, contained tornado.
Scientists always say it's safe, and then you know what happens next.
Something would have to go very wrong for this to cause any...
That's exactly any what you say. So what do you do with respect to this, then?
Well, in the top of here, instead of having a storm cloud that would generate a real tornado, we've got there's a motor that sucks air up the top. So instead of having, like, some strong convection, we've got a suction pump at the top, really. And then at the bottom we have a fog which generates like some clouds, so that helps us to visualise the airflow.
And on a serious note, clearly parts of America get used to tornadoes, and we've spoken to lots of our American correspondents who suffered them. They do seem to be becoming a more frequent occurrence within the British Isles. I mean, we've noticed them recently sort of cropping up in bizarre places, obviously mini tornadoes, but still as a phenomenon in itself. Is that to do with the dreaded G word, the global warming?
I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that yet. We'd need a lot more evidence before.
We're probably just getting better at seeing them. We know, because we have things like radar now to tell us where the tornadoes are at, when they're happening. Actually, you stand a much higher chance of seeing a tornado in England than you do of seeing one in America. The Netherlands gets the most, and then we're second on the...
Are you a tornado chaser? Because I know there's a group of people who actually sort of specifically they go hunting twisters.
No, but some of the members of our society are, so yeah, we know all about them.
And the final member of your fine team here who's so far sort of avoided the whole thing, your name?
It's Rachel Fardham.
Rachel, so what have you been doing apart from wearing a t-shirt, which is obviously you've got the blues, you've got the snow, you've got sort of the snow falling from the clouds, really?
So I've just been on hand to do some of the experiments outside, so we've been making clouds, getting the kids to have a look at the clouds as well, and we've got a weather station, so we've been recording the data and observations here, so showing everybody how the technical kit works as well.
Fantastic. Leslie, you've obviously been enjoying this. It would be very useful for your scouts movement, I would have thought, but questions for these fine folk?
I just think it's not so much of a question, but I think it's just a fantastic thing for the kids to come in and actually have a go at doing a little bit of weather forecasting, but hands-on experience develops their interest. Fantastic learning opportunity, I would have thought, yeah?
Thumbs up all round. And we did ask you, of course, to start off with, where are you going to after the Great Yorkshire Show?
Well, we're coming up to the end of our tour, really, with the roadshow, but our next event is in September, and that's in the Lee Valley Park down near London.
Excellent. And do we have a date for that? Is there a web address that people can access details on and find out where you're going to be?
Yeah, that would be opalexplorenature.org, and you'll find a link to our roadshow there.